Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
We're not idiots. We knew this was an uphill battle from the beginning, but the fact of the matter is that regardless of what happens at the Court of Appeals, either side, I think it's a pretty safe bet to assume that the other side is going to petition the Supreme Court regardless of the outcome.
We continue to hear about the Constitution and what it requires, and I don't disagree what they're saying, that it needs to reflect the state of Arizona. And if you take the totality of these people that have been nominated, we are moving much closer to reflect Arizona than it currently exists.
These commissions are the gatekeepers for the judges on our benches. These are the gatekeepers for the people that institute justice in our society. And these are the ones that are going to ensure that the public has confidence in our justice system, that it will actually be just.
According to the Constitution of the United States, he's supposed to be the people's attorney, and therefore he should not be in that office anymore.
And with us to talk about Attorney General Barr's testimony, the latest legislative news, and more are Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez and Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Good morning.
Jaime, let's start off with Attorney General Barr talking to the Senate, but not the House, which has already caused a major kerfuffle there. was his testimony before the Senate worthwhile at all?
I don't think so. I mean, it was all just political theater, right? I mean, it's emanating from the Mueller report that basically said there was no crime. But the big argument is how they released it and how it got given
spun
to Congress.
To some extent, too.
And so the Democrats are now trying to say, okay, well, we didn't like, and Mueller actually told the Attorney General, there were some things I disagreed with how you released it, but it wasn't the content of it. And that's the issue. There's really, what's the content? If there were issues that were not being put out that were problematic for the administration, i.e., if there were any criminal doings, it seems to me that would have been the lead. But this is more the process, and I think this is more Washington theater than anything else. Because if you look at what the public is looking at or thinking about, this really doesn't raise to the level of interest.
Marilyn, we heard the shortcut from Representative Gallego at the end there, saying that basically Attorney General Barr is supposed to be the attorney for the people, and it's acting almost as if an attorney for the administration. What did you make of his testimony and the fact he didn't speak to the House?
I agree with Representative Gallego. I think this is a true test of our Constitution right now, and this is, This is a true test of our Constitution, right, and the checks and balances, right, the power that Congress has and the obligation that Congress has to ensure that the president, the executive, is being transparent. It is no surprise to anyone listening that this administration historically has lacked transparency. There have been some major and concerning questions about his business dealings overseas, specifically with Russia. But beyond that, you know, what happened is Congress subpoenaed information, and that information continues to be obstructed, right? That is troubling. And I think we are barreling towards a constitutional crisis if Congress's ability to ensure that our government functions continues to be thwarted.
I mean, you refer to this as political theater. I'm wondering if in a hearing like this, we've seen all sorts of, you know, high-profile hearings over the last couple of years. In a situation like this, is it possible at this point for anybody's mind to be changed based on what anybody says, either in this case, Attorney General Barr or any members of the Senate committee?
No. Short answer, no. Well, because, you know, I think of this in terms of what happened in history. And you look at the Kenneth Starr report and what happened with then President Clinton. Very similar, but the roles were flipped, where the Democrats controlled the Senate, Republicans had the House, and now it's vice versa. And it's like Groundhog Day. I mean, we're going through the same process, the same political theater. At the end of the day, let's say they go through the motions of doing an impeachment, which Speaker Pelosi raised the stakes by saying the Attorney General lied. And that now puts her in a position where her progressive wing of the party, who has been pushing her for impeachment proceedings, now the stakes have been raised. And in my opinion, that plays into the administration's hands. Because, again, just like it played into President Clinton's hands when the Republicans went through this political theater, the American people are saying, well, if there's a crime that's been committed, that's one thing. But so far, the issue has been over and over again saying there was no crimes that was done. Yeah, there might have been, the process was flawed, there ability to get out the information in a timely and but those are the things that I think are going to hurt the administration, or excuse me, help the administration if the Democrats play this out to, in the point where it's just not going to be accepted by the public as real.
Marilyn, how do you see Washington Democrats handling this? Obviously, there is a push among some in the majority in Congress to go forward with impeachment. Speaker Pelosi, up until now, has been a little bit less enthusiastic about that. How do you see this playing out?
I think they're handling it very well. I feel like I would have lost my composure a heck of a lot sooner than they have. And, you know, to the point of lying, I mean, they have proof of that. And I think, you know, the politics are what are getting in the way of their ability to do their job. And what I'd like to see more of and haven't is our congressional delegation, mainly our senators, McSally and Sinema, telling us constituents who are very concerned, again, not just about the outcome of this case, right, with President Trump, but the outcome of, you know, the precedent this sets on the powers of Congress to ensure that, you know, we have a transparent and effective democracy, you know, left over after all of this. Where are they on this? I would like to know.
Is Senator Sinema feeling pressure? Should she, the fact that she went ahead and supported Attorney General Barr's nomination?
I think that as constituents, we should be asking them those questions.
Jaime, what do you think about that? The fact that you've got Kyrsten Sinema who has tried to play down the middle and has, and now Attorney General Barr is in the headlines. Maybe we expected that, maybe we didn't. Is there pressure on her? Is there, should there be pressure on Senator McSally too?
Oh, there sure is pressure on Senator Sinema, but I think the pressure is coming from her own party. There's a lot of members that are disappointed. I've read a number of stories where people are saying exactly that. She should need to be more aggressive with the administration, maybe be more aggressive with the Attorney General. But Senator Sinema is also very pragmatic in thinking about the end game here. She knows that the Republicans are digging in behind the president, and if this were to get carried out to the ultimate political theater, which would be the impeachment process, there's not the votes in the Senate to make it happen. And so she's been very effective in riding that middle lane where she's been able to attract Republican votes for things that she wants to do. She's been able to then, you know, work with the Democrats on a number of issues that rise to a higher level. So I think she's going to be very adept on how she proceeds.
How do you guys see this playing out? I mean, Marilyn, do you think ultimately that Democrats in the House move forward with impeachment? Do you think they try to maybe raise the stakes on trying to get rid of Attorney General Barr? What do you think ultimately happens here?
The Democrats in the House have made it very clear that they are trying to conduct an investigation. I think, you know, to Jaime's point that there aren't the votes there to impeach, that is something they're trying to, again, get to the bottom of. I think it's troubling that they don't have an unredacted copy of the Mueller report. I think it's troubling that every piece of information they try to pursue to get to a conclusion is being obstructed. And I think, you know, we are allowing, if we don't put more pressure on our leaders to cut through that politics, we're allowing politics to dictate the outcome.
One more political point on this that I want to ask Marilyn about first. So we knew that if Representative Gallego had run for Senate, that President Trump would be at the top of the headlines. He has not been shy about being critical of the president. Mark Kelly perhaps will do the same. After something like this comes out, for Democrats generally, is it disappointing that Representative Gallego is not going to be in this Senate race to keep raising this point over and over again?
I think Mr. Gallego, Representative Gallego, in his position in Congress is just as powerful, right? He's there on the Hill every day fighting. I encourage listeners to go to some of the videos of his impassioned speeches on the floor. He is holding the president accountable, I think, no matter what position he's in. And with candidate Kelly, I think, you know, as the as the election proceeds, I'd like to hear more from him on how he plans to hold the president accountable in the event that that is still the case, you know, after 2020. But frankly, I want him to focus on winning statewide and let Mr. Gallego focus on holding the president accountable for now.
I mean, what do you think about that? Would Democrats, would they have wanted the more aggressive approach of Representative Gallego?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's, again, that goes back to why Ms. McSally, Senator McSally, would have loved to have seen Mark Kelly against the Reuven Gallego, because it would have shifted into that type of a debate on the Democrat primary. Whereas, you know, I think she doesn't want to talk about those kinds of issues that Ms. Sinema was effective against her on. So it's interesting how that's, I think Mr. Kelly's breathing a sigh of relief.
Let's move on to some state stuff, guys. We're gonna talk about this more in our next segment as well. But let's get started on the state budget, because it seems as though Republicans, though the House is tighter, 31-29, Republicans still hold the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. So, Jaime, what's going on here? Why is
that's a good question.
Is this the usual dance that people want different priorities? The governor seems to have different priorities than Republican leadership. Is that a sign leadership is dramatically different from what we saw before?
Well, we talked about this at the beginning of the session. It is a somewhat inexperienced leadership, right? You have individuals that really have not had these positions before. And so this whole kerfuffle, I'm going to use your
words. My favorite
words,
word now, yeah.
Happened because rather than going through the process where the Senate president and staff and leadership kind of drove the budget process, you had an opportunity for the appropriations chairman puts together a budget that got leaked before anything was vetted or anything internally with the Republican caucus, where they said, okay, that's a budget we're kind of sort of behind. And then all heck broke loose. And actually what it's done, it's created a scenario, and I was telling Marilyn earlier, where I don't think the Democrats have to do any attack ads next year. If they adopt a budget like that, then they're going to give the House and the Senate to the Democrats, where they're eliminating kids care. They're cutting universities. They're not doing anything for K-12 education. It's almost an anti-kids type of a budget.
Marilyn, I want to get to that more after we go to break. But before we go to break, the fact that the word leak was used by Jaime is pretty interesting. What does that indicate? If there are leaks now, does that indicate there is definitely some dissatisfaction going on there?
I think that's true. I think, you know, we move from, hopefully, an instance where the public was never given any input on a budget process, where three people in a room decided what was going to happen and it was shoved through in the middle of the night, to perhaps an opportunity to open that process up. I think the people benefit right from this. And honestly, I was telling Jaime, this is the most transparent the budget process has ever felt. And it's kind of funny that the reason why is all the Republicans are mad at each other and can't get along.
That's Marilyn Rodriguez. Also here is Jaime Molero with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday newscap, which continues after this. Good morning. It's the Friday newscap here on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our panelists today are Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners and Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez.
And guys, we ended the last segment talking about the state budget. Let me ask another question. Marilyn, let me start with you on this. You mentioned that, you know, Democrats have been sort of involved in the sense that Republicans are sort of fighting amongst themselves. Given that the House, anyway, is a much closer split than we've seen in the past, what are you hearing from Democrats as far as the fact that they're, even with that tighter split, they're not really that involved in crafting a budget? It really seems to be what can get this number of Republican votes on a budget.
Yes, I think that is an important point, right? The voters sent a basically split House to go represent them, and the result all session has been that 31 members in the majority have largely been running the show. I think last I checked, two Democratic bills have squeaked out to the governor's desk. And at last I also checked, the minority leader, Representative Fernandez, made clear that they haven't been asked to the table on the most important conversation at the legislature, which is how to spend, you know, upwards of $10, $11 billion.
I mean, this is sort of standard operating procedure, has been in years past when there has been a larger partisan split. Is it in any way surprising that even with, you know, just a few members on either side here, that this is still the way it's going?
Not so much, because the Republicans are still in control and they still own the process. At the end of the day, they will get nailed, good or bad, even if they did reach out to Democrats. Democrats are still going to come out and say this is the most horrible, terrible budget, even if they included them from day one. So the thing that we also need to remember, though, is that the Republicans need to think in terms of how this might affect them a year and a half from now. And like we talked about in the previous segment, if they go down this path and they don't recognize that there are changing demographics in Arizona, that a number of districts are going to be more competitive now, and they do not recognize that by eliminating kids care, that could be a massive problem. By defunding in large measure universities, that could be a massive problem. All of those things combined, it led to that whole pressure cooker that created the Red for Ed movement. If that doesn't somehow, and it was a little bit dissipated last year by the 20 for 20, but if they don't somehow figure out how to get more in tune with what needs to happen, then they're really going to own it. And then they're really going to pay the political consequence because the Democrats are going to come back and take over.
Well, Jaime, how much does timing play into that? Because with Red for Ed, it was leading into an election.
Right.
I'm wondering how much voters are going to be paying attention in 18 months on what a state legislature did a year and a half earlier.
And so that's a great question, because if they were to do something as draconian as eliminate kids care, that becomes immediately a 2020 election issue starting now. And it gives the Democrats that momentum going into that next legislative session, as well as universities, as well as K-12. That's why there needs to be, and I agree with you, most of the time next year's budget will be much more moderate and everybody's going to be happy. But if they do these very, what I consider significant policy issues that will just dominate the headlines, then it's going to be hard to come back from that.
Marilyn, why don't you follow up on that? I think that's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. I think the legislature, especially one led by a majority that does not want to fund education, probably wants to pursue those cuts in a time where nobody's watching or nobody can go down, which is why I have heard a rumor that they would prefer to get that budget done before school is out in order to avoid a rush on the Capitol by the teachers who held them accountable last year.
And not that the governor has to care about every individual lawmaker, but how much influence would he have as far as arm twisting to avoid some of the draconian things Jaime is saying, even if there's not much university funding, but a little bit of that and not eliminating kids care? Do you think the governor is going to talk to leaders and say, this is going to be bad for the Republican Party if you do this?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's ultimately what it's going to boil down to here. The governor, fortunately, has put himself in a position where he has drawn the line, and he's even gone as far as vetoing legislation to make that clear, that there are certain things he wants in his budget. I think it's very smart because the House Democrats very recently, just yesterday, as we are negotiating this budget through the press, said they agree with him on many of his provisions. You know, they want a seat at the table. What I haven't seen is that they have been given that seat at the table. But the governor, you know, he isn't a part-time lawmaker, right? He is a full-time, that's a full-time job, right? He's down there all year. He has no ticking clock on per diem, right? So he can wait them out. And I think, you know, based on what he has said or what his staff has said, he wholly intends to do that.
Jaime, in talking about the budget and some of the differences in policy, two things that we haven't talked about that we have been talking about for months: tax conformity and what to do with this vehicle license fee that many legislators, especially Republicans, are really unhappy about. Is that an indication that maybe there are bigger gulfs than we thought, or is it just sort of the usual give and take of what happens during a budget process?
Well, it's the usual give and take what happens in the budget process. However, these two issues that you just mentioned, the federal tax conformity, where Arizona needs to conform with the federal tax law changes that were made a couple of years ago, and what we're going to do in whether or not we want to cap the vehicle license tax from $32 to a different amount, those are significant dollar amounts. And when you're trying to get a budget together, and the governor has made clear he wants to see a very significant increase in our rainy day fund, up to $1 billion. That will take a big chunk of the revenues that they have available. Now, you compound that by dealing with conformity, which is also a big ticket item. If you're going to reduce the vehicle license tax and how much that generates, that's another big ticket item. So it becomes a numbers game. Are you able to deal with all of those other issues that you want to, the things that we mentioned, university funding, K-12 funding, and at the same time try and become much more of a conservative budget by dealing with a much broader tax conformity or lowering the cap on VLT a lot more? So those are the issues that they're going to have to get together on.
Mm-hmm. One other topic we wanted to get to, guys, and this is the Arizona Department of Corrections. And Marilyn, it sort of comes back to the way the governor has handled things in the past. We no longer see Tim Jeffries in charge of an agency. We no longer see Sue Black in charge of an agency. Does this latest indication show that maybe this would be an embarrassment to the governor? Maybe Chuck Ryan is the next to go.
I mean, yeah, it's important to note Charles Ryan's tenure as DOC director has been a complete and utter failure. And that was the case before the governor took office. What was that, back in 2012? Ryan has presided over a correction system with patterns and a history of inhumane conditions that have led to unsafe working conditions, necessities like tampons, pads, and toilet papers being withheld from those incarcerated, and even multiple deaths. The fact that, you know, the governor has not fired Charles Ryan is astounding to me. And I think, you know, that is what needs to be the call to action. You saw even the House Republican caucus yesterday come out signing a letter, all of them signed a letter, many of whom have defended Charles Ryan in the past, saying that this needs to change, he needs to be held accountable, and they want to see this investigated. I think it's important to put that in stark contrast with the governor, who, even after those videos came out of Lewis Prison, that, you know, the locks weren't there and that guard was beaten to a point of having to be hospitalized and they're probably disabled for life, the governor still stood behind Charles Ryan. I think that is remarkable, and I am baffled.
I mean, a lot of people are saying the same thing about Sue Black at Parks. The governor has been someone who, some would say this is a compliment, some would say this is a criticism, that he has been a reactive governor in some ways, and when he sees things are problems, he will act on them. Does this put a lot of pressure on the governor?
It does, but I think also the governor is very cautious. I mean, he's a conservative individual, both in his political outlook, but also on how he approaches issues. And I think you've seen in Doug Ducey, he doesn't just take a media story and all of a sudden he goes, oh my goodness, we're gonna just fire everybody and then we're going to. He's very cautious and judicious about getting information. But then when he gets that information, as we've seen on other cases, Tim Jeffries is a good example. If the data and the information shows that there's problems that need to be addressed, he does then move fairly quickly.
Well, I mean, the data and the information shows that, you know, to speak to one of Governor Ducey's priorities is he wants to reduce recidivism. At no point during Charles Ryan's tenure has he done that, right? And so it feels like it's actually gone up. It's now over 50% of the individuals who are incarcerated will go back. It just feels like if rehabilitative services are the priority, then the only person getting a second chance right now in Arizona's correction system is Chuck Ryan.
Okay, just a few seconds left. Do we expect Chuck Ryan to still be in this position in the next couple of months?
I hope not.
Okay.
I do. I think unless there's massive amounts of data that comes out or information that comes out, I don't see him leaving.
Okay. I'm Malera of Malera Alvarez, Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at the show@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.